We keep our finger on the pulse of that and try to divert any crises.
Helping villages get their winter fuel supply. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 19th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young laments the loss of Democrats.
We lost those good members. Those people, I think, were good for the nation. Now, gives us a majority, yes, but I don't think it's necessarily good for the country.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A Bethel jury awarded a Quethluck man and his family more than $23 million after he was severely injured by a village public police officer. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Philip Nick, age 46, was injured on September 9, 2009. That night, he was walking in the village of Quethluck when two officers tried to arrest him. When village police officer Elias Sergey and tribal police officer Martin Alexi tried to restrain Nick, they caused him to drop to the ground. Alexi landed on top of Nick, and Nick hit his neck and back hard on the ground. Ultimately, Nick's spine was fractured. According to court documents, Nick said, quote, "My neck is broken." He couldn't move. Still, the two officers put him in handcuffs and proceeded to drag him to a four-wheeler. They dropped him once and finally got him on the machine. According to court reports, the officers then took him to the village health clinic, and then he was medevaced to Bethel and then on to Anchorage. Nick's injuries were permanent, and he is now a quadriplegic. He can no longer move his arms or legs. On Wednesday, the Bethel jury found that the city of Quethluck was negligent in its transport of Nick, causing him injury. They also found that the city was negligent when hiring Elias Sergey as a village police officer, which caused injury to Nick. The case focused on the village police officer, Sergey, and not the village tribal officer, Martin Alexi, because the tribe is a sovereign government and cannot be taken to court. Most of the $23 million awarded to Nick, nearly $18 million, is for future medical and life care costs. $1.1 million is for past medical costs. Each of Nick's four children, the oldest one being 20, were awarded about $500,000. Philip Nick has a long list of previous charges over the last 20 years at the Bethel Court. They include several assault charges as well as charges of domestic violence, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. Margaret Ficka, Quethluck's city manager, refused to answer any questions about the case or the court's decision. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The state of Alaska says Fuel Watch, a program designed to keep the heat and lights on in rural Alaska, is working well. It came about after several fuel-related crises in rural Alaska. In October 2008, the Alaska Federation of Natives called upon the federal and state governments to declare an energy emergency, where some residents were paying twice as much for heating, fuel, and gasoline as urban Alaskans. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
In 2008, early freeze-up in some communities kept barges from landing to deliver fuel. It was also a cold winter, so people had to use more heating oil than usual to stay warm. As villages ran low on fuel, the only way to get more was to have it delivered by airplane, an expensive alternative to barges. Plus, fuel prices were already at their peak, a third higher than in 2000. Director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, Tara Jolly, says staff started taking steps to help. In 2009, employees made about 1,500 phone calls to some 200 communities and to fuel suppliers. They made the calls again this year.
We made these calls. This year was 884 contacts to until we reach somebody to find out if they have fuel coming, if they have fuel ordered, do they need a loan to get the fuel. And so forth.
Jolly says the calls show that villages face a range of problems, including inadequate infrastructure.
They have storage issues. You know, they have small storage tanks and things like that. Or they have low water where you can't get in there with a barge at a certain time of the year. Mostly they need help with filling out applications for state loan.
The state has two no-interest or low-interest loan programs for communities that can't afford to pay for a full year's worth of fuel up front. Jolly says DCRA will continue to stay in touch with rural residents so things stay on track.
We keep our finger on the pulse of that and try to divert any crises.
The Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage has prepared studies for the state legislature and for community and regional affairs as they consider long-term remedies. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A federal judge this afternoon ordered the certification of Alaska's Senate race halted if Republican Joe Miller files a lawsuit in state court by Monday. U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein says Miller's complaint about the interpretation of election law and how it pertains to write-in ballots is a state matter. Beislein says that if Miller files a lawsuit in state court on or before Monday, the results of the race should not be certified until the legal issues raised have been fully resolved. Miller had earlier filed for suit in federal court, alleging the State Division of Elections had not correctly interpreted state election law by accepting write-in ballots that had misspelled candidates' names on them. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell says voter intent drives ballot acceptance. Judge Beislein required both state defendants and plaintiffs to address jurisdictional issues of where the case should be heard. The state has filed to dismiss the case. Miller also has complained that the division began its hand count of write-in ballots earlier than anticipated, which forced his campaign to fly volunteer ballot count watchers to Juneau sooner than he would have liked. The Division of Elections wants to certify the Senate election by November 29th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska Native artists uncover treasures at the Smithsonian.
So when that string is pulled, the puppet's chest opens up to reveal a little spirit of some sort in the chest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A member of the U.S. House has introduced a bill to alter the way Alaska Native corporations do business. It's a companion bill to a Senate version introduced earlier this week by Claire McCaskill of Missouri. Congressman Benny Thompson from Mississippi is the main House sponsor. The bill aims to strip away the advantages the Native corporations receive from the Small Business Administration's 8A program in getting federal contracts. Alaska Representative Don Young is bristling at the legislation and calls it an attack on Alaska. The bill won't likely get a hearing during the lame duck session, which will go into December. Congress is out for the Thanksgiving recess next week after a busy first week back. Newly elected House members visited D.C. this week for orientation and to pick their offices through a lottery process. With 93 new members, it's the largest freshman class in six decades. Only nine are Democrats, and the rest are Republicans. So many new faces that Republicans will have a strong majority in the House. Much has been made about the new wave of conservative representatives, some of whom have Tea Party support and have pledged to slash spending. But Congressman Young says he's seen the cycle before of confident newcomers who believe they can change Washington.
They're all the same as far as enthusiasm and think they're going to change the world overnight.
What they don't understand is democracy is a very cumbersome way of governing, and that's good. But they got ideas that they're going to do things that I don't think will be realistic. I admire them for attempting to do so. But I heard the same thing in 94. And every class has got a new idea how the world should go. And then we'll see whether they can achieve it or not. It may be hard to do. I think it will be.
Young is heading toward his 20th term in the House and is second in seniority among Republicans. He says the election on Thursday of Ohio Representative John Boehner as the new speaker and the picks for the Republican leadership were no surprise.
Sort of boring, you know, you think about it. Just everybody was, I would say, expected. And having said that, the greatest round of applause in our caucus was when it was announced that Nancy Pelosi had won the leadership on the Democrat side.
Young is often at odds with Speaker Pelosi, but he's also butted heads with top Republican Boehner about earmarks, of which Boehner instituted a party ban, and over Young's potential leadership roles. It was Boehner who pressured Young to step down from his ranking spot on the Natural Resources Committee 2 years ago because of federal investigations into his behavior. The Justice Department says Young is no longer under scrutiny, and he hopes to get a subcommittee chairmanship in the new Congress. Even though Young says he's pleased about the incoming Republican majority, he's disappointed it's coming at the cost of losing some of the centrist and conservative Democrats.
You know, Alan Boyd, Florida, agriculture, good sound person. Ike Skelton, outstanding. Neighbor, Jim Oberstar, 38 years of serving on the Hill, chairman. Outstanding in transportation, knew probably more than even myself in a lot of areas of transportation. We lost those good members. Some of them we lost, I don't really care. But those people, I think, were good for the nation. Now, gives us a majority, yes, but I don't think it's necessarily good for the country.
The divisions between Democrats and Republicans was apparent this week as Republicans tried to defund National Public Radio and blocked an extension of long-term unemployment benefits. Congressman Young voted with most other House Republicans yesterday against the unemployment benefits extension. Those against it say it should be offset by cuts elsewhere. The benefits are set to expire at the end of this month, and Democrats who support them say out-of-work Americans need the help. The final vote was 258 to 154, not the two-thirds majority needed for passage. All but 11 Democrats voted for it, and 21 Republicans crossed over to support it. Former Petersburg resident Cora Campbell is enthused about her appointment as acting commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. Governor Parnell announced cabinet selections yesterday. Campbell worked as a fisheries policy advisor and special assistant, first with Governor Palin and then with Parnell. Campbell has also worked on the board of directors for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, and earlier on in her career was executive director of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association. She grew up in Petersburg, commercial fishing with her family. Campbell has a bachelor's degree in education from Pacific Lutheran University. Campbell says she's excited about the opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate the governor's confidence in me, and I just want to make sure that progress continues on a lot of the good initiatives that are going on down there, and also I want to just re-energize and reinvigorate a few things, so I'm looking forward to it.
Campbell takes over as acting commissioner on December 1st with the retirement of Denby Lloyd. The governor will eventually name a permanent replacement for Lloyd after the Board of Fish and Board of Game solicit applications and come up with a list of nominees for the position. Campbell said state officials have been discussing the position since Lloyd announced his retirement earlier this fall.
We knew that we would have a gap between the time of his retirement and the time that the joint boards would complete their selection process to produce a list of names for the governor's consideration. So we knew that we would need an acting a natural fit because I've been working so closely with outgoing Commissioner Lloyd on department issues and initiatives, and so it's going to be a way to keep things rolling forward for the department.
Campbell says she will apply for the permanent commissioner's job through the joint board selection process. Another Parnell appointee who is eager to get started is incoming Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan. Currently the Attorney General for the state, Sullivan says Alaska has world-class reserves of oil, gas, minerals, and renewables. He says as Attorney General, his number one focus was on reducing sexual assault and domestic violence.
But certainly number two was working on creating the legal framework in the state to enable us to get control over our own resources. That's the beginning of responsible resource development. And we were very aggressive and have been very aggressive in that regard. So as the AG, I certainly worked on resource development issues, and that is certainly going to be a continued important focus.
Sullivan says he believes he has a lot of experience in resource development beyond his tenure as Attorney General, going back to his days as a U.S. official on global energy issues during the Bush administration.
But I know I have a lot to learn, and I think one of the most important things you can do starting a new job is to get out, listen to the excellent professional staff at DNR, listen to community leaders, listen to industry leaders, the legislature.
Sullivan says he'll listen to environmental and conservation groups also, saying they're an important part of responsible resource development. Sullivan says stakeholder buy-in on projects is critical. He says the example of development of NPRA permits is a good example of industry, native corporations, tribes, and local communities working out an agreeable plan that was ultimately held up by the Corps of Engineers.
Literally every stakeholder in Alaska compromised, came together. You know, opening up NPRA and the potential there is an enormous issue. They pull the rug out from under us, and you haven't heard the last from the state on that one at all. We should be hearing any day now whether or not the appeal that has been lodged on that decision is going to come back favorably for us or not. And if it's not favorable, stand by, because we'll be taking action.
Sullivan's appointment is effective on December 1st. Governor Parnell says the search for a new attorney general is underway.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
Alaska author Heather Lindy's name has been a familiar one in the Anchorage Daily News and Alaska Dispatch, and is now on a new column appearing in the monthly magazine Women's Day. Tara Bicknell has more from Haines.
In the pages of this month's Women's Day magazine, you can learn how to roll out a perfect pie crust or streamline holiday stress. But if you flip long enough, you'll see the name of someone you know, or at least someone who knows your name. You'll read that Haines looks like Switzerland with a beach, and that the police chief has a goat that he sometimes walks on a leash, and that cell phone reception from Mud Bay Road is bad on stormy days. It's all penned by Haines author Heather Lindy, and is the first publication of her new column in the prominent women's magazine.
And this is no different with Women's Day than it is anywhere. You know, to write in a way that is sort of, you know, I'm your friend, and I'm, you know, writing you a letter from Haines about what's going on.
Lindy is already a professional writer with two books, If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name, and Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. She wrote a long-running column in the Anchorage Daily News before that. The mother of five also continues to write obituaries for the Chilkat Valley News and host radio programs at KHNS and Haines. But it wasn't her resume as a writer exactly that landed her this latest gig. Actually, it was a church bulletin on the East Coast.
It's a pretty great story, really. The new book came out, you know, the Garden and the Dogs book, and my publisher, Algonquin, is very good at publicity, and so they had me traveling all over the country and doing these radio tours. So when I got home from all the tour stuff last spring, I wasn't that surprised that there was an email from the editor of Women's Day.
The message asked Lindy to write something for the magazine, which isn't that out of the ordinary for the author. But then the editor said, after reading Lindy's latest book, she wanted a regular column from her.
So I said yes, because I would say yes. But then I asked her how she found out about my book. And she said that she had gotten my book from her mother-in-law, who read about it in a church leaflet in Pine Plains, New York. I said, well, actually, you know, I have family in Pine Plains, New York. And she said it was St. Peter's. And St. Peter's is the church that my mother went to. And my dad is the one that made him put a little note about my book in the church bulletin. so that's how it happened. That's how I got in Women's Day.
This first column is part of the November issue of Women's Day, and Lendy says the editors wanted it to introduce Haynes to the new crop of readers.
It's basically not going to be a whole lot different than my Anchorage Daily News column, except it's, you know, pretty much just only for women.
Although Lendy's written for a variety of audiences, she admits surprise that she's writing for American women who want to learn to roll out the perfect pie crust or streamline holiday stress.
At the same time, when I think about it, as much as I guess, you know, you'd think, oh, I wish I could write for the New Yorker or something, maybe I am more Women's Day, you know, and it seems so far to be a pretty good fit.
Lendy's new 1,000-word column about life in Haynes begins with the November issue of Women's Day magazine.
That story was from KHNS reporter Tara Bicknell. It used to be that museums had a reputation of taking away from Alaska Native communities their artwork, cultural artifacts, and even burial remains. But the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian strives to work with Alaska Natives and Native Americans to keep culture alive. One of its programs has sent two Alaska artists to Washington, D.C. for 2 weeks of hands-on time with the museum's collection. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Artist John Hudson is Tsimshian, and his family comes from Metlakatla in southeast Alaska, but he hadn't seen or heard a Tsimshian horn until last year in the Smithsonian collection.
I came out here to study rattles and clappers and things and try to help create things that would enhance our dance groups back in Metlakatla, and I kept coming across these things that were labeled as Tsimshian trumpets, you know, and I started calling around, and not too many people really knew about. We'd had whistles and these other noisemakers, but this one has an inner double-beating reed made out of yellow cedar.
Hudson examined the Tsimshian trumpets, diagrammed them, explored inside them with a flashlight, and after reading a 100-year-old description, he was able to carve his own version. He says one hadn't been made since at least before 1887.
And I kind of figured it out. You know, I still don't know exactly how they were used. We're going to be trying to find appropriate ways for us to use them now.
Hudson, who's Scottish and Danish, in addition to Tsimshian, says many of Metlakatla's rich artistic traditions were lost when Christian missionaries encouraged dropping their customs, something he used to resent but has now found peace with. He says he respects the decisions of the ancestors he calls brilliant people. His father is credited with helping revive traditional arts in Metlakatla, so after John Hudson spent time digging into the Smithsonian collection, he followed in his father's footsteps and brought the skill of making traditional Tsimshian horns back to Metlakatla, teaching classes to carvers. He took a video of the local dance group incorporating the new trumpets into their performance. That's the purpose of the Artist Leadership Program. Outreach coordinator for museum programs, Kevin Lewis, says for him, it's personal and part of the evolving role museums can play. He points to the National Museum of the American Indian Act, which, along with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, lets Native people request and get back parts of their culture.
Ever since those legislations came about, museums had to change their attitude on how to work with contemporary Native people. And whether it's through repatriation or outreach programs like the Artist Leadership Program, that's how things get returned back home.
John Hudson is again at the museum collection this month, now focused on Tsimshian puppets, another lost art. He was able to spend time with a particular puppet, at least a century old, that he'd seen for years in books.
You know, I call him the Nachnach, but that's a generic term in Tsimshian, which means something magical or something supernatural or something having powers beyond the norm. And he was still fully intact with original rigging and strings that were still operational, so I got to stand him up. And then there's another little portion of the chest that has a string to it. So when that string is pulled, the puppet's chest opens up to reveal a little spirit of some sort in the chest. you know, it's really a masterpiece of design, craftsmanship, and aesthetic quality.
Another Alaskan artist studying at the Smithsonian Collection is Erica Lord, originally from Nenana. She's been poring over old photographs and listening to recordings, too.
It was incredibly touching. Like I was just saying, we had a potlatch in Nenana just last week, and some of the elders were saying, does anyone even remember the porcupine dance? And not a lot of people did know, and so they were trying to sing it, but just we didn't have a lot of people that knew how to sing it or how to dance it. And then last Friday, one of the last things I found before the end of the day was one audio reel that said porcupine dance from Minto. And you know, it's like it couldn't get any closer than Minto, so I was really excited.
Lord is 32 years old and works in mixed media, much of it centering around her identity and the Native diaspora. She's Athabascan, Inupiaq, European, and Japanese. But she says that isn't confusing for her. It's rich.
What I try to do with my art is to sort of stimulate dialogue and conversation about that it's not something that has to be a problem, you know, that it's something really beautiful and amazing. And just because our culture changes doesn't necessarily mean we're losing it or it's becoming any less authentic or real. We'll always be real.
After Lord spends 2 weeks at the Smithsonian Collection, she plans to go back to Nenana and lead a mural project with local students celebrating their rich heritage. They'll look at old photographs and historical archives, then document their own lives. Lord hopes the students can get paid to work on the murals to inspire them for future jobs.
You can work in your village, that you can do work with your culture and your community and your creativity, and that can actually become a job or a career or a life.
Lord says she hopes the project brings a new creative force to Nenana and also gives the kids pride in their identity and community, their modern, diverse Native community. The two Alaskan artists, now at the National Museum of the American Indian, will soon head home, and in May, applications are due for the next group of Indigenous artists hoping to visit the collections. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.